Welcome once again to our little bit of study time. This is Alan Jones, Grand Prairie Church of Christ, Highland Park location. Today we're going to be looking at the Gospel of Mark, chapter 2, beginning with verse 23 and going right through to chapter 3, verse 6, which will conclude the five controversies that Mark records in this little chunk we've been looking at the last few weeks.
And I'm Scott Pence. I'm the pastor at the Mission Heights site here in Grand Prairie.
And I'm David Hockley from Coldstream Christian Church in Coldstream, British Columbia.
Very good. All right, so we started this new thing, a little quick review of how things went last Sunday and connecting to this week. So away we go. I tried to tie last Sunday with the Sunday before, and the whole issue of standing on God's truth and holding on to his compassion, bringing that together with the broken world. And basically sort of concluded with how many ways does the gospel of grace burst my wineskin? And then talked a little bit about that and thinking about that for our lives. Talked a little bit about just kind of an illustration at the end about when a wineskin bursts and the wine gets all over, it stains. And could it be possible that every encounter we have, we leave the stain of grace on people's life because of how we've interacted with them? So that was my attempt anyway. I think it went not too bad, probably, I don't know, 6.5.
It's just so important that we make sure that we do the rating on this. That's the main thing here. So
you rate yourself pretty harshly.
We stormed out of the building, right?
I started with the question, as a Christian, how do I respond to someone whose life and choices are opposed to the values that I hold deeply, and some different versions of that basic question, and then went into the story of Jesus calling Levi and the response of the Pharisees. Tried to be sympathetic to the Pharisees, at least where they were coming from, and why Jesus eating with Levi and tax collectors and such would upset them. And But circle back around to the fact that there are all these layers of offense that tax collectors represented, and yet Jesus went and ate with these guys and so on. And I closed out with a similar image to Jones. It's the one that I remember him doing originally. I might remember it wrongly. Maybe it's the way I just shifted it in my head. But I had a picture of a tree that was rooted in the ground, but was blowing sideways, and talk about needing to be deeply rooted in the character and relationship with God and the scriptures, but bending as far as we could go to in grace for other people or whatnot. I think people appreciated the image and got good feedback on that afterwards. Mm.
I did a couple things. I wanted to kind of tie in with the what a doctor does. I actually called some doctor friends and asked them where do they find the most joy, and where do they find the least joy in their work. And the most joy was when somebody comes in who's really sick, their intervention makes a difference. And what's the least joyful is when somebody comes in and basically wants the doctors to endorse the treatment that they already have in mind.
Right.
You know, and don't really need their expert advice. They just need their check mark kind of thing, you know. So, which I don't think that's just thinking back. I don't think I tapped into how that would relate to the Pharisees who already had their solution. Yeah. I have to admit though, Scott, when you talk about the sympathy for the Pharisees, the Rolling Stones song "Sympathy for the Devil" came to mind. You don't know that song?
I don't know.
I bet you if you heard it, you would know it.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I'm not a big Rolling Stones guy, so.
Yeah. But it's just, it's one that gets lots, he has gotten lots of airplay over time. But anyway, you can listen to that. But anyway, it's a, so, so anyway, yeah, just sorry. I'm just sorry that came to mind. I don't know. It's probably inappropriate on my part to say that, but.
No, for me, but, I was just, it's, at root, these are guys who desperately wanted God to come back to their people.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, yeah. And they thought that the way of doing this was to, was for Israel to be as faithful to Torah as possible. And so to see an influential teacher eating with people that were so deeply offensive on political, religious, economic, social, and personal levels would, in their mind, think this is going to set us back.
Yeah, yeah. So. No, I get that. I talked about that as well. Like, yeah. they really weren't, you know, desiring to be evil people at heart. They just ended up being that way by, because their blindness to some things is what got them there. I kind of wrapped up with a parable of a bus driver who stopped with this one, at his rest stop. There was this kind of parking lot area where he stopped his bus to rest. It was just, people used it to dump all their refuse and all the things that were just distasteful. And, you know, it was in, it was really bugging him. And he just hated. And then, so finally one day he decided, I've got 7 minutes for my rest stop. I'm going to take 5 of that and just pack up some garbage. Just every day, just tear back up garbage. Then it started looking not bad. So he thought, maybe I'll plant some flowers. And then people on the bus started to kind of just staying on the bus an extra, you know, a little past their stop so they could come and spend some time in this park, you know, and just talking about how, you know, when we find something distasteful, our tendency is to move away from it as opposed to embrace it, kind of thing. And so that seemed to resonate. And we had a discussion afterwards and kind of asked people what their way of feeling, what things repulse them. Cause I found it's really quite different. For some people it's sexual sin, and for others it's, you know, it's somebody who lies or is misleading or manipulative, you know, or, you know, there's, everybody has their own thing that they just are repulsed by. And we can never seem to understand why somebody can tolerate one person and get along fine with another. When we can tolerate the person that's repulsed them, but can't stand the person that they tolerate, you know? And so we just had that, some good discussion around that and what that looked like. And so.
Where'd you find that story about the truck stop or whatever?
The bus driver. I actually found it on Preaching Today.
Okay.
In illustrations, and I called it a parable because I had no way of verifying whether it was a real thing or not. So I thought, I'll just call it a parable, and because they didn't they didn't give any source of it, so I didn't have a source. So
right.
I thought maybe that's a good way to talk about something if you got a good illustration but don't have a source, is just call it a parable.
Yeah.
So.
No, that works.
Yeah. So, So I think it went reasonably well. I think I got reasonably good feedback on it, but kind of hard because you don't see many people. So sometimes just your source of feedback is pretty small circle sometimes. But
yeah, I hear that.
Yeah. So this passage today, what kind of jumped out for you guys?
Kind of for me, as I read the two passages, the two pericopes, I guess, what struck me is that Jesus kind of responds to the Pharisees, it seems to me, on three levels. The first is to expose their kind of judgmental hypocrisy that manifests as lack of compassion. And then to call them to the purpose of, in this case, Sabbath, and then to confront them with his lordship. So I've been trying to kind of think along those lines, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to think about how lack of compassion for people sometimes is a little bit of a flag or a marker potentially that I'm holding something in a position that maybe it ought not be in. It's kind of what I'm trying to mine those kinds of thoughts right now.
Yeah, did you read, do you guys spend any time in Lange commentary this week?
In Lane?
Lane, yeah, I'm sorry, yeah.
I read it. Yeah, I read it. I didn't find it overly stimulating, but...
No, I found he got, like, he was brought up the textual issue that I kept reading over and over and said, I don't really understand what the issue is here. Doesn't seem like a... Where does he talk about that? I'm just going to flip through my notes here.
Like a manuscript textual? There's the whole thing about the thing Jesus, Mark has the wrong high priest.
Yeah, the Abiathar thing.
Oh, yeah.
Is that it?
That was the one thing that it's kind of like a non-consequential kind of thing.
Yeah, me too.
So
depends on your whole deal with inspiration, if that's a real
if you're a littlest that God gives word for word inspiration, that becomes problematic.
The wrong priest, like he names his dad and it was really the son, right? Or the other way around, I can't remember which. No, he names the son and it was really the dad, right?
I think the first way it was names the dad and it really was the son, I think. No,
since actually Ahimelech, Abiathar's father. Yeah, so really, really the guy in 1 Samuel 21, he's dealing with Ahimelech.
Right.
Who's the dad.
Yeah.
And he names Abiathar.
Abiathar, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So,
if you're... want to pick, it's an error, I suppose, is what some guys would argue. Other guys say, no, it's because the son's the one that's most aligned with David's reign, so that's why he does it.
Or the other reference is that it's the place in the scroll that you would look for under Abiathar. Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you're rolling back the scroll, that's where you would roll back to. Find the story about that. So
the person gets into it, the defense of it that I found most helpful, because it doesn't say it was actually Abiathar. It says, verse 26, in the days of Abiathar. So, even though he may have been interacting with his dad, it still was in that guy's day. And for David, Abiathar was the key high priest. So I think... Okay.
That's
the sense of defense of it.
It's not an exact marker so much as a period marker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah, and that kind of makes sense. I just thought I'd bring it up because Lane goes on for quite a long time on that.
Yeah, well, quite a few guys make a big deal of it, because it's. Well, as I say, it depends on your view of inspiration. It could be a real hiccup.
Are you going to bring it up in your sermon at all?
No.
Probably not.
Not at all. Okay. It kind of goes off in a completely different direction from kind of where I feel like my thing's probably headed. So.
Yeah, people who want to know, they can listen to this podcast.
What did you say?
If people want to know, they can listen to this podcast.
Exactly. Yeah.
No, Rhonda Johnson years ago, sitting in a design team meeting for a Sunday morning, said to me after looking at what I had, whatever mess I had offered them up as far as where I was planning on going, she said something like, "I've never preached a sermon," she said, "but it always seemed to me that one of the big tasks of preparing a sermon was deciding what you're not going to say."
It's like, do I need to say this? Is it important to say? Is it
stuck with me? So
yeah, it's that whole thing about trying to be honest with the text and honest with any issues. You're like, we're not hiding anything, but you just don't have time. You in 20 to 30 minutes, there's a lot of things you can't explain well.
Yeah.
So you're best not to explain it at all.
I have two things. One, similar to what Scott said with Rhonda, we had Monica, she, in a Bible study, she, something came up, I wasn't there, and it reminded her of my sermon. She digs into her purse and notes she'd taken. Just wait, and she goes, a bunch of Jones crap, oh yeah, here it is, and digs through all this technical Jones crap, as she says, to come up with a point that was relevant to life. So. And then the other one is John Wilson, who always said, look, don't waste your good ideas on sermons. You got to save it for classes where you can develop stuff. For me, I'm just trying to figure, you know, I can't remember who said it. Maybe it might have been an author I read by a fellow by the name of Parsons. But anyway, he just talked about how when it comes to that whole thing about, you know, the Sabbath is made for man, not man for the Sabbath, and then Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. He just talked about how we as human beings tend to gravitate towards this statement of freedom. And we use that text all the time to say why we don't have to obey the law, why we're free to do this, why. And he said, but that's not the point of the text. The point of the text is the authority of Jesus. But we gravitate towards this, anything that sounds like freedom we want. And so I think that's right. And so I'm trying to think about how that would figure out. And then Tom Wright, you know, when he's looking at these passages, one of the third question he asks about is this: can we recover the sanity and blessing of Sabbath in a dehumanizing world where money is driven as crazy? And so trying to think through the whole thing about, you know, has our grasping for freedom and escape from the law caused us to ignore the lordship of Jesus and allow another king to take over commerce?
Can you ask that question again? Has our grasping for freedom, I'm writing this down.
Has our grasping for freedom overruled the authority and lordship of Jesus? And it, as a result, allowed other tyrannical rulers to come into to life. Whereas Jesus, when he's Lord, he brings life. Mm. And we subject in our attempt to be free, we've tossed Jesus' authority out, allowed somebody else to take authority, and now we die. So the whole thing is, you know, does our freedom from Sabbath, does it help or kill my life? Does it help or kill my marriage? Does it help or kill my relationship with friends? Does it help or kill my relationship with children? You know, missing the point of the passage, the authority of Jesus, and that he wants to bring life to all, I think is messing us up. So that's kind of, I don't know if that's where I'll go, but that's what I've been thinking about for the last little bit.
Yeah, because Jesus doesn't ignore the Sabbath at all. He just says you've gotten the wrong end of the stick about it.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, that piece struck me as well.
The I was reading a sermon on by Brian, what's his name? Brian Wilkerson, who's wrote a pretty good book on preaching. Anyway, he it's out of Preaching Today. I saved the PDF to our shared file.
I couldn't find that. Like, yeah, that's
I went to look today and it wasn't there, so it is there now.
Oh, okay.
I resaved it, but he does it. His is just on the last six verses, right? You know, in terms of what Jesus does with this, which I think is kind of the act where we get the action. That's also where the authority of Jesus is declared too, right? You know, so I find that the passages really are really dealing with the same issue all the way through. So whether you preached on the last first six verses of chapter three or the last six of chapter two, I think your sermon's pretty much the same. He kind of comes around this whole idea of doing good, and he doesn't really spend as much time in the lordship of Jesus, which I think is important to add in there. He talks a little bit about that, but he does point out that Jesus is a bit of a rebel, because he said the reality is that he could have healed Jesus the next day.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a life or death situation. And so the fact that he did it on that day, shows, a bit of rebellion. It was a little bit of I could accomplish working within your rules, but I'm not going to.
Yeah, I mean, it's just prophetic. His role as a prophet to confront whatever the hypocrisy or a subtle idolatry, that kind of thing in the people of God, calling for kind of justice and mercy like the prophets in the Old Testament did. So,
and I actually like that take as opposed to he's a rebel.
Yeah.
That rebel attitude feeds into the people who said, I'm rebelling against anybody's rules and Jesus wasn't rebelling against their rules. He was being prophetic against their. So I think you hit it on the nail on the head with that. I think Chapel misses it by just saying he's a rebel. Because the prophet isn't a rebel for being a rebel's sake.
Exactly. I think that's important.
I think too, in addition to the prophetic act, this whole deal about that Tom Wright brings out here about Jesus being the king, and that's why he drags up King David. That, is that this event in David's life happened in the already, but not yet. He'd already been named as king and anointed as king, etc., but he hadn't been enthroned. So this is a bit of a pointing towards Jesus being the king, and the lordship over the Sabbath is as the anointed but not yet enthroned king.
Anointed but not yet what?
Just say it again.
The whole thing?
No, the last part.
No, just that the last part. Anointed but not
enthroned, but not yet enthroned king.
And I think there's a preaching point on that. This whole idea, like in terms of how we live our lives, talking to as if Jesus is king. It's easy in the church to have people kind of acknowledging the anointing, but not the enthroning in terms of our lives. Complete submission and devotion to Jesus. That I think that enthroned part is easy to kind of drop off in our personal lives, right? And we give a lip service to the anointing in that sense, and then we're talking about it and acknowledging it, but not actually submitting to it.
Yeah.
Which goes back to what we've been talking about the last 2 weeks, radical grace and this standing on God's transforming truth. Like the truth changes us. Last week I did the examples, like when a doctor comes in to you, he doesn't come in and say, God bless you and God bless your cancer.
Yeah.
He says, God bless you, and let's deal with this cancer. Let's get this out of you. Let's cut it out, radiate it out. Some way get this thing out of you because it'll kill you.
Your doctor says God bless you to you when you go in?
Some of them do. Yeah, I get most of my doctors are Christian guys. So.
Oh, good enough.
Yeah, so. So otherwise they wouldn't, I don't know necessarily they would start every conversation with that, but. I think that's a good point. I really like that. I got some of these pieces. I don't know how to quite preach it, but I think I like the ideas behind that. One of the things that Chapel talks about is what are the distinguishing mark of God's people? What do they do that sets us apart? And he talks about just that caring for people. And he had this interesting little activity, just trying to find it here. You guys can bring up some other points. I'll keep looking here, and then I'll...
I think on the marks of God's people, so Rick Watts has this whole thing that the mark of Christianity is that it gives life. The Lordship of Christ gives life whichever way that comes. That's the mark.
Are you guys... going to talk about Sabbath itself much, or either what it meant for them or what concepts still are potentially important for us? I mean, you kind of alluded to that a bit, but.
Yeah, I was thinking I might do that just by way of the application, because I really do think that parsons deal about it brings life. You know, we want all this freedom, but the freedom doesn't bring life. It is not under the lordship of Christ.
Yeah.
And so what's the best way to honor? One of the best ways to honor Christ's lordship in our culture and our society right now might be to bring back the concept of Sabbath, rest, and using it for relationship with God, with each other, with ourselves.
So would you then have suggestions for how people might celebrate or?
I might. I wanted to go back. I was trying to remember Buchanan's book, you know, on Sabbath.
The rest of God?
Yeah, I was trying to think back a couple of years ago since I read that. Now I can't remember the main things. I remember he had some good stuff on that.
I think I have that somewhere.
Yeah, I think we read it for something. Some reason we read. I think the pastor led our staff retreat or something.
Okay. Here's the part that I thought Chapel does a good point of. He makes an observation that because they're not in Jerusalem, they're in a small town around Galilee, right? And so, and he's in the synagogue, and so this man is in the synagogue, and I think we read it like this is Jesus just comes upon him. And these guys are all just there, and here's this anonymous person. The reality is this guy has probably been in the synagogue every Sabbath, and these guys have seen him for weeks and weeks and weeks, months and months, maybe years and years and years, right?
Yeah.
So this guy is actually known to them.
Yeah.
But it's like he's invisible. You know, they've been walking, Chapel does the thing, but how do we, understanding the Sabbath is learning how to see what Jesus sees and, seeing people. And he said one of the things they started doing, they gave people some brightly colored index cards to carry around. And he said, our assignment is to open the eyes to the people and situations we encounter from day to day and write down any needs that we see and any opportunity to do good for someone somewhere. And he said, I found this little assignment changed the way I make my way through the week. He said, I pay more attention to people. I'm looking them in the eye, I'm noticing their names. I'm asking myself what their days might be like and what might make their days a little more easier or better, more like what God has in mind for them. When you start looking at people that way, there are no ordinary people. There are no unremarkable encounters. It's a great paragraph.
Yeah.
And I think it even fits with the whole theme of our series, Amazing Encounters with Jesus. Is part of that is, we get those when we start having those amazing encounters ourselves when we see what Jesus sees in other people. I want to find a way to talk about invisible people and how do we respond to them? How do we bring them the truth of the into the lordship of Christ over the other things that battle with that, like the. So
it was worse than invisible. I mean, for the Pharisees, he became just seen as a tool for their evil.
For their evil?
Yeah. They say, oh, I know how we can get Jesus. We'll use him to heal Fred here, and then we can accuse him.
Huh.
So he's just an object, a tool, which is what ticks Jesus off. So yeah. I like that idea of how can we bring Sabbath, healing, rest, wholeness to the people around us as we see him. I like that.
Speaking of Jesus being ticked off, I'm going to talk about that at all. We did a little thing on the potential of Jesus being angry earlier, but here there's no debate. He says he looked at them in anger, around in anger.
Strauss says the tenses of the verbs are important here. The looking around at them in anger was momentary, aorist tense, but being deeply distressed was continuous, present tense. So while Jesus was angry for his anger lasts but for a moment, his mercy lasts for a lifetime. So there's right there in that little verse, there's that whole capturing of God's heart.
Which
chapter 3, verse 5.
After looking around at them in anger, grieved. That's the NET Bible uses the word anger and grieved.
Yeah.
So those are the two words, eh?
Yeah.
Angry.
Although grieved is what I think it's pretty similar to how God is described when he decides to bring the flood. I don't know if it's an exact parallel, but it's a similar idea.
Which would make those anger and distressed
almost parallel.
Parallel in verse 5, not a contrast.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I wonder what didn't look at it very many of the translations to see if they all sort of wrote it as a contrast or as a compliment.
So the aorist tense is that it's present tense and.
No, aorist comes to an end. Present has that carries with it continuous action. But if it's just wishful thinking, that deeper distress is a positive rather than a parallel to anger, then that's all
it's
wishful
a,
thinking anyhow.
It's a once used word, the word for grief there. That's the only place in the New Testament it's used. So.
Interesting. Is it used in the Septuagint? Is that what you were referring to about?
I have no idea. I didn't. I just was. Just the idea of God being kind of grieved that he made mankind. Sorry, that he made mankind flood. Just seems similar to me. I don't know if I don't know if lexically they're the same.
It's worth having a little peek into. I think you know.
Do you have a copy of the Septuagint or?
I don't know. I've been using online stuff for so long. I don't even know what I've got in my library. Do you have a copy of the Septuagint?
No. I just try to find it somewhere online. Yep.
Should be able to dig it up. So, Wonder if Kale and Delich have a little do they kind of get into that at all? I have to dust one of those off and pull them out, I guess, eh?
Yeah, have to check it out a bit.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. When I first read the passage, I thought, you know, it seems so simple and straightforward, you know, just do good, don't let the rules get in the way. But there's actually so much more going on here, isn't there?
Yeah.
Almost always.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the central point is the authority of Jesus.
This is when you think about how he ends it, this is so that. Oh yeah. Verse 28 of chapter for this reason, the Son of Man is Lord, even of the Sabbath.
Yeah.
So how long do you think the then represents in chapter 3, verse 1? Is it like the next Saturday? Or is this the same? This is like.
I don't know. The version I have says another time.
Another time.
In verse 20.
It's just the word.
Chapter 3, verse 1.
It's just the word Kai, right? Which could be Anne for that matter.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think.
I don't think there's a lot to be made of that.
I think it's Mark's editorial stuff, putting those five parts of those things together.
Yeah. So, like, obviously, like for Mark, he's just like, say, here's two different incidences that you need to know how that these things fit together around the Lordship of Jesus.
Yeah.
And this is what King Jesus and prophetic Jesus does to our wrong understandings.
Well, I think, you know, it just is building the antagonism of the Pharisees and the religious leaders, because, you know, there's no sign of them objecting when he cast the demon out of the guy in the synagogue here a few verses ago. You know, that was in the synagogue on the Sabbath, and they didn't get all worked up. Matter of fact, that might be how they even knew that they could get Jesus. Oh, maybe we can get him here.
Mm-hmm.
Change in attitude.
How much should we align ourselves with how we react to Jesus when he doesn't cooperate with us, when they wanted to assassinate him. How does that, how much of a correlation is there to us and how we react when Jesus doesn't cooperate with our ambitions?
Well, it definitely ticks me off. And I'm more tempted to sin in various ways when God doesn't cooperate with my plans.
By that, do you mean if, when you have a ministry idea or desire and it just doesn't pan out? Or
yeah, that would be a perfect example.
Oh, can you say that again, Scott?
Oh, I was just asking if for Alan, it was when he had a ministry idea that he went to put into play and it just doesn't really pan out. Like,
yeah, it's like, fine then. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because it can be even good. It can even be good ideas, but if it doesn't kind of work out, yeah. You know, the idea itself isn't sinful, but we can get ticked off if we don't get our way.
Yeah. The Pharisees, we're trying to keep the law here, buddy. What are you doing?
Yeah. And like I said, their intention behind it wasn't bad, but
any number of church plants that fail, right?
Yeah,
at great cost emotionally and time and relationally sometimes. It's tough.
I read something that said the other day, it was just one of those little social media little quips, but it was about the sovereignty of God and the deal that God may call you to do something or other, but it doesn't mean he calls you to succeed at it. it's like, yep. And it's kind of the Isaiah thing, right? I want you to go preach and they are not going to listen.
Yeah, with Jeremiah too, there's a reason he's the weeping prophet, right?
Yep. Ever hearing, never understanding. Yeah.
Different economy than ours.
Called to be faithful, not to succeed. Well, you know, and that goes back to, I think all the preachers' conferences, we used to come and start and say, tell you how God's blessing you. And like, and someone would say, God's, you know, it was like some people like think of, oh, well, we've had like, you know, 400 baptisms and blah, 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 and all the lists of, and you get to other guys, you can see they're just sinking down in their chairs because they got nothing to say, you know? So that we quit talking about how God is asking the question, how is God blessing your ministry? We started saying, well, what's the funniest thing that's happened in ministry this year? Yeah, it was, everybody had one of those.
Yeah. Well, anything else stand out or core
problems? Yeah, got some work to do here to pull this together in a way that makes sense, but I see some really good stuff here.
Yeah. It's I think for me, Jesus is King who brings life, but how do we make that something that's something interesting and exciting rather than just a proclamation?
Yeah, I like the idea of giving somebody, some people, something tangible that they can use to kind of see people, just to see them. And since most people are attending online, I can't really hand out cards for people, but something that will help people actually see and the people that they walk by all the time. So that's bringing life out.
Yeah. I know one of the notes, you know, I've been trying to read Mark a couple of times a week for a few months now. And one of the notes I made to myself on that whole thing, I think it was on this passage where, you know, what do I look for? You know, here they are looking for a reason to accuse Jesus. So how do I go through life? Do I go through life looking to accuse or looking to bless, looking to give life, looking to defend myself and my position? What do I look for? One of my little meditations I had when I was doing this devotion. I didn't get the idea about them being blind to that guy.
Yeah.
A good addition. What do I look for? The The king looks to give life. I look for my freedom to do whatever I want, irrespective of other people and something else.
Which I think is, I think that's a really good conversation point around this whole idea of what do you see and what keeps us from seeing? Because I think if I'm looking for something, if I'm looking for something, I cannot see other things. I saw a quote, I can't remember who said it. It was that somebody posted, it says that we don't see the world as it is, we see the world as we are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the problem is if we don't find a way to get out of ourselves, you know, then like say, then we see others differently than God. Yeah. So that's a good, I think that's, I got lots of good preaching points here, guys. So I think this is awesome.
Great text.
the never fail compliment to whoever's preaching, right? That's a great text. I love that text you chose.
Mr. L?
Or? Yeah, Mr. L. Yeah.
Yeah, you didn't know Mr. L, did you?
I didn't have him for any kind of class, but I knew him a bit.
Oh, did you? Okay. Yeah, that would have. He had some great lines. He was iconic. Kind of like when you go to Emmanuel and you hear the stories of the founding four guys. There's some pretty great stories there, eh? You know, like.
I wandered into his room at the hospital. Pretty much right about when he was about to die.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because it's been a long time now, eh? So.
Yeah. I was up visiting somebody from our church and I heard that he was in there. And so I just thought I'd pop in to pray with him and that kind of thing. And I walked in and he's completely surrounded by his family.
Run, Congress, run!
They were super gracious, like super gracious. And so I chatted with them for a couple of minutes, but then I made my way out. It's not really my time to be there.
I know you don't know me, but
exactly. I knew one or two of them. I'd met them. Because one of them recognized me and called me by name and that kind of thing. But
yeah. lessons in pastoral ministry. Yeah. So, well, any other great insights before we wrap up? We kind of started to wrap up three times and had great things to make notes on every time. So. But
for me,
that's it.
Okay. Let me pray us out of here then.
Okay, sounds good.
Heavenly Father, we come before you and such a some powerful truths here about your lordship and your work to set us free from the things that blind us, from the things that cripple us. And seeing who you are more clearly in all this is so important. And so, Father, as we preach, may people see you this week. May they see you and have their own vision adjusted. May we see you and have our own vision adjusted. So, Father, I grant your Spirit's clarifying purposes in our lives as we try and get a sense of what it means to really put this passage and the truths in this passage to work in our lives. We ask this blessing on all of us and our families and our churches that we might be beacons of light for the name of your Son. In his name we pray. Amen.
Amen.